Arcady and the ferals did not pursue, but came gleefully romping back over to Temeraire, alternating complaints at his having knocked them about, with boastful prancing over their victory and the rout of the enemy, which Arcady implied was in spite of Temeraire's jealous interference.
"That is not true at all," Temeraire said, outraged. "You would have been perfectly dished without me,"
and turned his back upon them and flew towards land, his ruff stiffened up with indignation. They found Ringe sitting and licking at her scarred wing in the middle of a field. A few clumps of blood-stained white wool upon the grass and a certain atmosphere of carnage in the air suggested she had quietly found herself some consolation. But Lawrence chose to be blind. Arcady immediately set up as a hero for her benefit and paraded back and forth to re-enact the encounter. So far as Lawrence could follow, the battle might have raged a fortnight and engaged some hundreds of enemy beasts, all of them vanquished by Arcady's solitary efforts. Temeraire snorted and flicked his tail in disdain, but the other ferals proved perfectly happy to applaud the revisionary account, though they occasionally jumped up to interject stories of their own noble exploits. Lawrence, meanwhile, had dismounted. His new surgeon, Dorset, a rather thin and nervous young man, bespectacled and given to stammering, was going over Ringe's injuries.
"Will she be well enough to make the flight back to Dover?"
Lawrence inquired. The scraped wing looked nasty, what he could see of it. She uneasily kept trying to fold it close and away from the inspection, though fortunately Arcady's theatrics were keeping her distracted enough that Dorset could make some attempt at handling it. "No," Dorset said, with not the shade of a stammer, and a quite casual authority.
"She needs lie quiet a day or so under a poultice, and those balls must come out of her shoulder presently, although not now. There is a courier ground outside Weymouth which has been taken off the routes and will be free from infection. We must find a way to get her there."
He let go the wing and turned back to Lawrence, blinking his watery eyes.
"Very well,"
Lawrence said, bemused, at the change in his demeanour more than the certainty alone.
"Mr. Ferris, have you the maps?"
"Yes, sir. There is 12 miles straight flying to Weymouth covered across the water, sir, if you please,"
Ferris said, hesitating over the leather wallet of maps. Lawrence nodded and waved them away.
"Temeraire can support her so far, I'm sure."
Her weight posed less difficulty than her unease with the proposed arrangement, and, too, Arcady's sudden fit of jealousy, which caused him to propose himself as a substitute. Quite ineligible, as Ringe outweighed him by several tons, and they should not have got a yard off the ground.
"Pray do not be so silly,"
Temeraire said, as she dubiously expressed her reservations at being ferried.
"I am not going to drop you unless you bite me. You have only to lie quiet, and it is a very short way."
Chapter 3. But they reached Weymouth Covert only a little short of dusk, in much perturbation of spirit, Ringe having expressed the intention 5 or 6 times during the course of their flight of climbing off mid-air to fly the rest of the way herself. Then she had accidentally scratched Temeraire twice, and thrown a couple of the top men clean off his back with her uneasy shifting, their lives saved only by their carabiner-locked straps. On landing they were both handed down, bruised and ill from the knocking about they had taken, and helped away by their fellows to be dosed liberally with brandy at the small barracks house. Ringe put up a singular fuss to having the bullets extracted, sidling away her hind quarters when Dorset approached, knife in hand, insisting she was quite well, but Temeraire was sufficiently exasperated by now to have no patience with her evasions, his low rumbling growl resonating upon the dry, hard-packed earth, made her meekly flatten to the ground and submit to being picked over with a lantern suspended overhead.
"That will do,"
Dorset said, having pried out the third and final of the balls.
"Now some fresh meat, to be sure, and a night's quiet rest. This ground is too hard," he added with disapproval, as he climbed down from her shoulder, with the 3 balls rattling bloodily in his little basin.
"I do not care if he's the hardest ground in Britain. Only pray let me have a cow and I will sleep,"
Temeraire said wearily, leaning his head so Lawrence could stroke his muzzle while his own shallow cuts were poulticed. He ate the cow in 3 tremendous, tearing gulps, hooves to horns, tipping his head backwards to let the last bite of the hind quarters go down his throat. The farmer, who had been prevailed upon to bring some of his beasts to the covert, stood paralysed in a macabre sort of fascination, his mouth gaping, and his two sons likewise, with their eyes staring from their heads. Lawrence pressed a few more guineas into the man's unresisting hand, and hurried them all off. It would do Temeraire's cause no good to have fresh and lurid tales of draconic savagery spreading. The ferals disposed of themselves directly around the wounded Ringe, sheltering her from any draught, and pillowing themselves one upon the other as comfortably as they could manage, the smaller ones among them crawling upon Temeraire's back directly he had fallen asleep. It was too cold to sleep out, and they had not brought tents with them on patrol. Lawrence meant to leave the barracks, small enough in all conscience, without dividing off a captain's partition, to his men, and take himself to a hotel if one might be had. In any case, he would have been glad of a chance to send word back to Dover by the stage that their absence would not occasion distress. He did not trust any of the ferals to go alone yet, with their few officers so unfamiliar. Ferris approached as Lawrence made inquiry of the few tenants of the covert.
"Sir, if you please, my family are here in Weymouth. I'm sure my mother would be very happy if you chose to stay the night," he said,
adding with a quick, anxious glance that belied the easy way in which he issued this invitation.
"I should only like to send word ahead."
"That is handsome of you, Mr. Ferris. I would be grateful if I should not be putting her out,"
Lawrence said. He did not miss the anxiety. In courtesy, Ferris likely felt compelled to make the invitation, if his family had so much as an attic corner and a crust of bread to spare. Most of his younger gentlemen, indeed most of the corps, were drawn from the ranks of what could only be called the shabby genteel, and Lawrence knew they were inclined to think him higher than he did himself. His father kept a grand state, certainly, but Lawrence had not spent 3 months together at home since taking to sea, without much sorrow on either side, except perhaps his mother's, and was better accustomed to a hanging berth than a manor. Out of sympathy he would have spared Ferris, but for the likely difficulty of finding any other lodgings, and his own weary desire to be settled, even if it were only in an attic corner with a crust of bread. The noise of the day behind them, he was finding it difficult not to yield to a certain lowness of spirit. The ferals had behaved quite as badly as expected, and he could not help but see how impossible it should be to guard the channel with such a company. The contrast could not have been greater to the fine and ordered ranks of British formations, those ranks now decimated, and he felt their absence all the more keenly for it. The word was accordingly sent, and a carriage summoned. It was waiting outside the covert gates by the time they had gathered their things and walked to meet it down the long, narrow path which led away from the dragon clearings. A 20 minutes' drive brought them to the outskirts of Weymouth. Ferris grew steadily more hunched as they bowled along, and so miserably white that Lawrence might have thought him taken ill with the motion, if he had not seen Ferris perfectly settled through thunderstorm aloft and typhoon at sea, and not likely to be distressed by the motion of a comfortable, well-sprung chaise. The carriage turned, then, drawing into a heavily wooded lane, and Lawrence realized his mistake as the forest parted, and they drew abreast the house. A vast and sprawling Gothic sort of edifice, the blackened stone barely to be seen behind centuries of ivy, the windows all illuminated and throwing a beautiful golden light out onto a small ornamental brook which wound through the open lawn before the house.
"A very fine prospect, Mr. Ferris," Lawrence said as they rattled over the bridge. "You must be sorry not to be home more often. Does your family reside here long?"
"Oh, a dog's age," Ferris said blankly, lifting his head. "There was some crusader or other first built the place, I think. I don't know."
Lawrence hesitated, and a little reluctantly offered,
"My own father and I have disagreed on certain of our occasions, I am sorry to say, so I am not often at home."
"Mine is dead," Ferris said.
After a moment he seemed to realize this was a rather abrupt period to the conversation, and added with an effort,
"My brother Albert is a good sort, I suppose. He has 10 years on me, so we have never really got to know one another."
"Ah," Lawrence said, left no more the wiser as to the cause of Ferris's dismay. There was certainly nothing lacking in their welcome. Lawrence had braced himself for neglect. Perhaps they would be shown directly to their rooms, out of sight of the rest of the company. He was tired enough to even hope to be so slighted. But nothing of the sort. A dozen footmen were out with their lights lining the drive, another two waiting with a step to hand them down, and a substantial body of the staff coming outside to greet them, despite the cold and what must surely have been a full house within to manage, a wholly unnecessary ostentation. Ferris blurted desperately just as the horses were drawn up, "Sir, I hope you will not take it to heart if my mother—" "She means well." The footman opened the door, and discretion stopped Ferris's mouth. They were shown directly to the drawing-room, to find all the company assembled to meet them, not very large, but decidedly elegant, the women all in clothing of unfamiliar style, the surest mark of the height of fashion to a man who was often from society a year at a time, and several of the gentlemen bordering on outright dandyism. Lawrence noted it mechanically. He was himself in trousers and hessians, and those stained with dust, but he could not be brought to care very much, even when he saw the other gentlemen in the greater formality of knee-breeches. There were a couple of military men among their number, a colonel of marines, whose long, seamy, sun-leathered face had a certain vague familiarity that meant they had most likely dined together on one ship or another, and a tall army captain in his red coat, lantern-jawed and blue-eyed.
"Henry, my dear!"
A tall woman rose from her seat to come and greet them with both her hands outstretched, too like Ferris to mistake her, with the same high forehead and reddish-brown hair, and the same trick of holding her head very straight, which made her neck look longer.
"How happy we are you have come!"
"Mother,"
Ferris said woodenly, and bent to kiss her presented cheek.
"I present Captain Lawrence. Sir, this is Lady Catherine Seymour, my mother."
"Captain Lawrence, I am overjoyed to make your acquaintance,"
she said, offering him her hand.
"My lady,"
Lawrence said, giving her a formal leg.
"I am very sorry to intrude upon you. I beg you will forgive our coming in all our dirt."
"Any officer of His Majesty's Aerial Corps is welcome in this house, Captain," she declared, "at any moment of day or night, I assure you, and should he come with no introduction at all, still he should be welcome."
Lawrence did not know what to say to this. He himself would no more have descended upon a strange house without introduction than he would have robbed it. The hour was late, but not uncivilized, and he came with her own son, so in any case these reassurances were not much to the point. He could not have supposed it otherwise, having been invited and welcomed. He settled on a vague,
"Very kind."
The company was not similarly effusive. Ferris's eldest brother Albert, the present Lord Seymour, was a little high in the instep, and made a point early on, when Lawrence had made a compliment to his house, of conveying the intelligence that the house was Hightham Abbey, in the possession of the family since the reign of Charles II. The head of the family had risen from knight to baronet to baron in steady climb, and there remained.
"I congratulate you,"
Lawrence said, and did not take the opening to puff off his own consequence. He was an aviator, and well knew that one evil outweighed any other considerations in the eyes of the world. He could not help but wonder that they should have sent a son to the corps. There was no sign of the pressure of an encumbered estate, which might have made one reason. While appearances might have been kept up on credit, so extravagant a number of servants could not have been managed. Shortly dinner was announced, to Lawrence's surprise. He had hoped for nothing more than a little cold supper, and thought them arrived late for even this much.
"Oh, think nothing of it. We are grown modern, and often keep town hours even when we are in the country,"
Lady Catherine cried.
"We have so much company from London that it would be tiresome for them to be always shifting their dinner hour early, and sending away dishes half-eaten to be wished for later. Now, we will certainly not stand on formality. I must have Henry beside me, for I long to hear all you have been doing, my dear, and Captain Lawrence, you shall take in Lady Seymour, of course."
Lawrence could only bow politely and offer his arm, although Lord Seymour certainly ought to have preceded him, even if Lady Catherine chose to make a natural exception for her son. Her daughter-in-law looked for a moment as if she liked to balk, Lawrence thought, but then she laid her hand on his arm without any further hesitation, and he chose not to notice.
"Henry is my youngest, you know,"
Lady Catherine said to Lawrence over the second course. He was on her right.
"Second sons in this house have always gone to the drum, and the third to the corps, and I hope that may never change."
This, Lawrence thought, might have been subtly directed at his dinner companion by the direction of her eyes, but Lady Seymour gave no sign she had heard. She was correctly speaking with the gentleman on her right, the army captain who was Ferris's brother Richard.
"'I am very glad, Captain, to meet a gentleman whose family feels as I do on the matter.'
Lawrence, who had only narrowly escaped being thrown from the house by his irate father on his shift in profession, could not in honesty accept this compliment, and with some awkwardness said, "'Ma'am, I beg your pardon. I must confess you do us credit we have not earned. Younger sons in my family go to the church, but I was mad for the sea and would have no other profession.' He had then to explain his wholly accidental acquisition of Temeraire and subsequent transfer to the aerial corps.
"'I will not withdraw my remarks. It is even more to their credit that you were given good principles enough to do your duty when it was presented to you,' Lady Catherine said firmly. "'It is shameful, the disdain that so many of our finest families will profess for the corps, and I certainly will never hold with it in the least.'
The dishes were being changed again as she made this ringing and over-loud speech, and Lawrence noticed that they were going back nearly untouched after all. The food had been excellent, and he could only conceive, after a moment, that all Lady Catherine's protestations were a humbug. They had already dined earlier. He watched covertly as the next course was dished out, and indeed the ladies in particular picked unenthusiastically at their food, scarcely making pretence of conveying a single morsel to their mouths. Of the gentlemen, only Colonel Prale was making any serious inroads. He caught Lawrence looking and gave him the slightest bit of a wink, and then went on eating with a steady trencherman rhythm of a professional soldier used to take his food when it was before him. If they had been a large party, coming late to an empty house, Lawrence might have conceived of a gracious host holding back dinner for their convenience, or serving a second meal to the newcomers, but not under such pretence, as though they should have been offended with a simple supper, served to them privately, the rest of the company having dined. He was obliged to sit through several more removes, conscious they were a pleasure to no one else of the company. Ferrius himself ate with his head down, and only lightly, though in the ordinary course of events, he was as rapacious as any 19-year-old boy unpredictably fed of late. When the ladies departed to the drawing-room, Lord Seymour began to offer port and cigars, with a determined if false note of heartiness. But Lawrence refused all but the smallest glass he could take for politeness's sake, and no one objected to rejoining the ladies quickly, they most of them already beginning to droop by the fire, even though not half an hour had elapsed. No one proposed cards or music. The conversation was low and leaden.
"'How dull you all are tonight!'
Lady Catherine rallied them with a nervous energy.
"'You will give Captain Lawrence quite a disgust of our society. You cannot often have been in Dorsetshire, Captain, I suppose?'
"'I have not had that pleasure, ma'am,' Lawrence said. "'My uncle lives near Wimborne, but I have not visited him in many years.'
"'Oh, perhaps you are acquainted with Mrs. Brantham's family?'
That lady, who had been nodding off, aroused enough to say with sleepy tactlessness,
"'I am sure not.'
"'It's not very likely, ma'am. My uncle moves very little outside his political circles,' Lawrence said after a pause. "'In any event, my services kept me from the enjoyment of much wider society, particularly these last years.'
"'But what compensations you must have had,' Lady Catherine said. "'I am sure it must be glorious to travel by dragon, without any worry that you shall be sunk in a gale, and so much more quickly.'
"'Ha-ha! Unless your ship grows tired of the journey and eats you,'
Captain Ferris said, nudging his younger brother with an elbow.
"'Richard, what nonsense! As if there were any danger of such a thing. I must insist on your withdrawing the remark,' Lady Catherine said. "'You will offend our guest.'
"'Not at all, ma'am,'
Lawrence said, discomforted. The vigour of her objection gave an undeserved weight to the joke, which in any case he could more easily have borne than her compliments. He could not help but feel them excessive and insincere.
"'You are kind to be so tolerant,' she said. "'Of course, Richard was only joking, but you would be quite appalled how many people in society will say such things and believe them. I am sure it is very poor-spirited to be afraid of dragons.'
"'I am afraid it is only the natural consequence,' Lawrence said, of the unfortunate situation prevailing in our country, which keeps dragons so isolated in their distant coverts as to make them a point of horror.
"'Why, what else is to be done with them?' Lord Seymour said. "'Put them in the village square.'
He amused himself greatly with this suggestion. He was uncomfortably florid in the face, having performed heroically his host's duties at the second dinner. He even now was doing justice to another glass of port, over which he coughed his laugh.
"'In China,
"They may be seen in the streets of every town and city," Lawrence said.
"They sleep in pavilions no more separated from residences than one townhouse from another in London."
"Heavens! I should not sleep a wink," Mrs. Brantham said, with a shudder. "How dreadful these foreign customs!"
"It seems to me a most peculiar arrangement," Seymour said, his brows drawing together. "Look here, how do the horses stand it? My driver in town must go a mile out of his way when the wind is in the wrong quarter and blowing over the covert, because the beasts get skittish."
Lawrence was in honesty forced to admit they did not. Horses were not often to be seen in the Chinese cities, except for the trained cavalry beasts.
"But I assure you the lack is not felt. Aside from mule carts, they have also dragons employed as a sort of living stagecoach, and citizens of higher estate are conveyed by courier at what you can imagine must be a much higher rate of speed. Indeed, Bonaparte has already adopted the system, at least within his encampments."
"Oh, Bonaparte," Seymour said. "No, thank goodness we organise things more sensibly here. I have been meaning to congratulate you, rather. Ordinarily not a month goes by when my tenants are not complaining of the patrols going overhead and frightening their cattle to pieces, leaving their—" he waved his hand expressively in concession to the ladies— "everywhere. But this 6 months, not a peep. I suppose you've put in new routes, and none too soon. I had nearly made up my mind to speak on the matter in Parliament."
This remark, thoroughly aware as he was of the circumstances which had reduced the frequency of the patrols, Lawrence could not make himself answer civilly. So he did not answer at all, and instead went to fill his glass again. He took it away and went to stand by the window farthest from the fire, to keep himself refreshed by the cool draught which came in. Lady Seymour had taken a seat beside it for the same reason. She had put aside her wine-glass and was fanning herself. When he had stood there a moment, she made a visible effort and engaged him.
"So you had to shift from the Navy to the Aerial Corps. It must have been very hard. I suppose you went to sea when you were older."
"At the age of 12, ma'am," Lawrence said.
"Oh, but then you came home again, from time to time, surely. And 12 is not 7. No one can say there is no difference. I'm sure your mother must never have thought of sending you from home at such an age."
Lawrence hesitated, conscious that Lady Catherine, and indeed most of the other company, which had not already dozed off, were now listening to their conversation.
"I was fortunate to secure a berth more often than not, so I was not much at home myself," he said as neutrally as he could. "I am sure it must be hard for a mother, in either case."
"Hard? Of course it is hard," Lady Catherine said, interjecting here. "What of it? We ought to have the courage to send our sons, if we expect them to have the courage to go, and not this sort of half-hearted grudging sacrifice, to send them so late they are too old to properly take to the life."
"I suppose," Lady Seymour said, with an angry smile, "that we might also starve our children to accustom them to privation, and send them to sleep in a pigsty, so they might learn to endure filth and cold, if we cared very little for them."
What little other conversation had gone forward now was extinguished quite. Spots of colour stood high in Lady Catherine's cheeks, and Lord Seymour was snoring prudently by the fire, his eyes shut. Poor Lieutenant Ferris had retreated into the opposite corner of the room and was staring fixedly out the window into the pitch-dark grounds, where nothing was to be seen. Lawrence, sorry to have so blundered into an existing quarrel, by way of making peace, said,
"I hope you will permit me to say I find the corps as an occupation has been given a character which it does not deserve, being no more dangerous or distasteful in daily use than any other branch. I can at least say from my own experience that our sailors face as much hard duty, and I am sure Captain Ferris and Colonel Prale will attest to the privations of their own respective services."
He raised his glass to those gentlemen.
"Hear, hear,"
Prale said, coming to his aid jovially.
"It is not aviators only who have all the hard luck, but we fellows too, who deserve our fair share of your sympathy. And at least you may be sure they have all the latest news at any moment. You must know better than any of us, Captain Lawrence, what is going forward on the continent now. Is Bonaparte setting up for invasion again, now he has packed the Russians off home?"
"Oh, pray do not speak of that monster,"
Mrs. Brantham spoke up.
"I am sure I have never heard anything half so dreadful as what he has done to the poor Queen of Prussia, taken both her sons away to Paris."
At this, Lady Seymour, still high-coloured, burst out,
"I am sure she must be in agony. What mother's heart could bear it?
Mine would break to pieces, I know.
I am sorry to hear it, Lawrence said to Mrs. Brantham into the awkward silence. They were very brave children.
Henry tells me you had the honour to meet them, Captain Lawrence, and the Queen during your service, Lady Catherine said. I am sure you must agree that however much her heart should break, she would never ask her sons to be cowards and hide behind her skirts.
He could say nothing, but only gave her a bow. Lady Seymour was looking out the window and fanning herself with short, jerking strokes. The conversation limped on a very little longer until he felt he could in politeness excuse himself on the grounds of the necessity of an early departure. He was shown to a handsome room with signs of having been hastily rearranged, and someone's comb left by the wash-basin suggested it had been otherwise occupied until perhaps that evening. Lawrence shook his head at this fresh sign of over-solicitousness, and was sorry any of the guests should have been shifted on his account. Lieutenant Ferris knocked timidly on his door before a quarter of an hour had passed, and when admitted, tried to express his regrets without precisely apologizing, as he could scarcely do.
"I only wish she would not feel it so. I did not like to go at the time, I suppose, and she cannot forget that I wept,"
he said, fidgeting the curtain uneasily. He was looking out the window to avoid meeting Lawrence's eyes.
"But that was only being afraid at leaving home, as any child would be. I'm not sorry for it now at all, and I would not give up the corps for anything."
He soon made his good nights and escaped again, leaving Lawrence to the rueful consideration that the cold and open hostility of his father might yet be preferable to a welcome so anxious and smothering. One of the footmen tapped at the door to valet Lawrence directly Ferris had gone, but he had nothing to do. Lawrence had grown so used to doing for himself that his coat was already off and his boots in the corner, although he was glad enough to send those for blacking. He had been abed scarcely a quarter of an hour before he was roused again by a great clamour of barking from the kennels and the horses shrilling madly. He went to the window. Lights were coming on in the distant stables, and he heard a thin, faint whistling somewhere aloft, carrying clear from a distance.
"Bring my boots at once, if you please, and tell the household to remain within doors," Lawrence told the footman, who came hurrying at his ring.
He went down in some disarray, still tying his neckcloth, the flare in his hand.
"Clear away there!"
he called strongly. Some number of the servants gathered in the open court before the house.
"Clear away! The dragons will need room to land."
This intelligence left the courtyard empty. Ferris was already hurrying out with his own signal flare and a candle. He knelt down to set off the blue light, which went hissing up into the air and burst high. The night was clear and the moon only a thin slice. Almost at once the whistling came again, louder. Gerne's high, ringing voice, and she came down to them in a rustle of wings.
"Henry, is that your dragon? Where do you all sit?"
said Captain Ferris, coming down the stairs cautiously. Gerne, whose head did not come up to the second-story windows, indeed would have been hard-pressed to carry more than 4 or 5 men. While no dragon could precisely be called charming, her blue-and-white china complexion was elegant, and the dark softened the edges of her claws and teeth into a less threatening shape. Lawrence was heartened that some other few of the party, still dressed more or less, had gathered on the stoop to see her. She cocked her head at the question, and said something inquiringly in the dragon tongue, quite incomprehensible to them all, then sat up on her hind legs to call out a piercing answer to some cry which only she had heard. Temeraire's more resonant voice became audible to them all, answering, and he came down into the wide lawn behind her, the lamps gleaming on his obsidian glossy scales in their thousands, and his shivering wings kicking up a spray of dust and small pebbles, which rattled against the walls like small shot. He curved down his head from its great serpentine height, well clear of the roof of the house.
"Harry, Lawrence, pray," he said. "A courier came and dropped a message to tell us there is a fleur de nuit bothering the ships off Boulogne. I have sent Arcady and the others to chase them away, but I do not trust them to mind without me there."
"No, indeed," Lawrence said, and turned only to shake Captain Ferris's hand.
But there was no sign of him, or of any living soul, but Ferris and Gerne. The doors had been shut up tight, and the windows all were close shuttered before they lifted away.
"Well, we are in for it, make no mistake," Jane said, having taken his report in Temeraire's clearing.
The first skirmish off Weymouth, and the nuisance of chasing away the fleur-de-nuit, and besides those, another alarm which had roused them after a few more hours of snatched sleep, and quite unnecessarily, for they arrived only in time at the edge of dawn to catch sight of a single French courier vanishing off over the horizon, chased by the orange gouts of cannon fire from the fearsome shore battery which had lately been established at Plymouth.
"These were none of them real attacks," Lawrence said. "Even that skirmish, though they provoked it. If they had worsted us, they could not have stayed to take any advantage of it. Not such small dragons. Not if they wished to get themselves home again before they were forced to collapse on shore."
He had given his men leave to snatch some sleep on the way back, and his own eyes had closed once or twice during the flight. But that was nothing to seeing Temeraire almost grey with fatigue, his wings tucked limply against his back.
"No, they are probing our defences, and more aggressively than I had looked for," Jane said. "I am afraid they have grown suspicious. They chased you into Scotland without hide nor wing of another dragon to be seen. The French are not fools to overlook something like that, however badly it ended for them. If any one of those beasts gets into the countryside and flies over the quarantine coverts, the game will be up. They will know they have free rein."
"How have you kept them from growing suspicious before?" Lawrence said. "Surely they must have noted the absence of our patrols."
"We have managed to disguise the situation so far by sending out the sick for short patrols on clear days when they can be seen for a good distance," Jane said. "A good many of them can still fly, and even fight for a while, although none of them can stand up to a long journey. They tire too easily, and they feel the cold more than they should. They complain of their bones aching, and the winter has only made matters worse."
"Oh, if they are laying upon the ground, I am not surprised they do not feel well," Temeraire said, rousing and lifting up his head. "Of course they feel the cold. I feel it myself when the ground is so hard and frozen, and I am not sick at all."
"Dear fellow," Jane said, "I would make it summer again if I could, but there is nowhere else for them to sleep."
"They must have pavilions," Temeraire said.
"Pavilions?" Jane said.
And Lawrence went into his small sea chest and brought out to her the thick packet which had come with them all the way from China, wrapped many times over with oilcloth and twine, the outer layers stained nearly black, the inner still pale, until he came to the thin, fine rice paper inside, with the plans for the dragon pavilion laid out upon them.
"Just see if the Admiralty will pay for such a thing," Jane said dryly, but she looked the designs over with a thoughtful, more than a critical eye. "It is a clever arrangement, and I dare say it would make them a damned sight more comfortable than lying on damp ground. I do hear the ones at Lochlagan do better, where they have the heat from the baths underground, and the longwings who are quartered in the sand-pits have held up better, though they do not like it in the least."
"I am sure that if only they had the pavilions, and some more appetizing food to eat, they would soon get better. I did not like to eat at all when I had my cold, until the Chinese cooked for me," Temeraire said.
"I will second that," Lawrence said. "He scarcely ate at all before. Keynes was of the opinion the strength of spices compensated, to some part, for the inability to smell or taste."
"Well, for that, any rate, I can squeeze out a few guineas here and there and manage a trial. We have certainly not been spending half of what we ordinarily would in powder," Jane said. "It will not do for very long, not if we are to feed 200 dragons spiced meals. And where am I to get the cooks to manage it? I have no idea. But if we see some improvement, we may have some better luck in persuading their lordships to carry the project forward."
Chapter 4 Gong Su was enlisted in the cause, and all but emptied his spice cabinets, making especially vigorous use of his sharpest peppers, much to the intense disapproval of the herdsmen, who were rousted from a post usually requiring little more than dragging cows from pen to slaughter, and set to stirring pungent cauldrons. The effect was a marked one. The dragons' appetites more startled awake than coaxed, and many of the nearly somnolent beasts began clamouring with fresh hunger. The spices were not easily replaced, however, and Gong Su shook his head with dissatisfaction over what the Dover merchants could provide. The cost even of this astronomical.
"Lawrence," Jane said, having called him to her quarters for dinner, "I hope you will forgive me for serving you a shabby trick. I mean to send you to plead our case. I do not like to leave Exidium for long now, and I cannot take him over London sneezing as he does. We can manage a couple of patrols here while you are gone, and make it a rest for Temeraire. He needs one in any case."
"What?
No, thank heaven, that fellow Barham, who gave you so much difficulty, is out. Grenville has the place now. Not a bad fellow, so far as I can tell. If he does not understand the least thing about dragons, that hardly makes him unique. And I will say, privately, in your ear, she added later that evening, reaching over for the glass of wine by the bed and settling back against his arm, Lawrence lying back, thoroughly breathless, with his eyes half closed, the sweat still standing on his shoulders, that I would not hazard 2 pins for my chances of persuading him to anything. He yielded to Powis in the end over my appointment, but he can scarcely bear to address a note to me, and the truth is I have made use of his mortification to squeak through 6 orders I've not quite the authority for, which I am sure he would have liked to object to if he could do so without summoning me. Our chances are precious small to begin, and we will do a good deal better with you there. It did not prove the case, however, because Jane, at least, could scarcely have been refused admittance by one of the secretaries of the Navy, a tall, thin, officious fellow who said impatiently, "Yes, yes, I have your numbers written in front of me, and in any case you may be sure we have taken note of the higher requisitions of cattle, but have any of them recovered? You say nothing of it. How many can fly now that could not before, and how long?" As if, Lawrence felt resentfully, he were inquiring about the improved performance of a ship, given changes in her cordage or sailcloth.
The surgeons are of the opinion that with these measures we can hope to greatly retard the further progress of the illness, Lawrence said. He could not claim that any had recovered, which alone must be of material benefit, and perhaps with these pavilions also.
The secretary was shaking his head. If they will do no better than now, I cannot give you any encouragement. We must still build these shore batteries all along the coastline, and if you imagine dragons are expensive, you have not seen the cost of guns.
All the more reason to care for the dragons we have, and spend a little more to safeguard their remaining strength,
Lawrence said. His frustration added,
And especially so, sir, that it is no more than their just deserts from us, for their service. These are thinking creatures, not cavalry horses.
Oh, romantical notions! The secretary said, dismissive. Very well, Captain. I regret to inform you his lordship is occupied today. We have your report. You may be sure he will reply to it when he has time. I can give you an appointment next week, perhaps.
Lawrence, with difficulty, restrained himself from replying to this incivility as he felt it deserved, and went out feeling he had been a far worse messenger than Jane herself would have been. His spirits were not to be recovered even by the treat of catching a glimpse of the lately created Duke of Nelson in the courtyard, that gentleman splendid in his dress uniform and his peculiar row of misshapen medals. They had been half melted to the skin at Trafalgar, when a pass by the Spanish fire-breather there had caught his flagship, and his life nearly despaired of from the dreadful burns. Lawrence was glad to see him so recovered. A line of pink, scarred skin was visible upon his jaw, running down his throat into the high collar of his coat, but this did not deter him from talking energetically with, or rather to, a small group of attentive officers, his one arm gesturing. A crowd had collected at a respectful distance to overhear, placed so that Lawrence had to push his way out to the street through them, making apologies muttered as softly as he could. He might have stayed to listen himself another time. At present he had to make his way through the streets, a thick, dark slurry of half-frozen ice and muck chilling his boots, back to the London covert, where Temeraire was waiting anxiously to receive the unhappy news.
"But surely there must be some means of reaching him," Temeraire said. "I cannot bear that our friends should all grow worse, when we have so easy a remedy at hand."
"We will have to manage on what we can afford within the current bounds, and stretch that little out," Lawrence said. But some effect may be produced by the searing of the meat alone, or stewing. Let us not despair, my dear, but hope that Gong Su's ingenuity may yet find some answer.
I do not suppose this Grenville eats raw beef every night, with the hide still on, and no salt, and then goes to sleep on the ground, Temeraire said resentfully. I should like to see him try it a week and then refuse us.
His tail was lashing dangerously at the already denuded treetops around the edge of the clearing. Lawrence did not suppose it either, and it occurred to him that the First Lord might very likely dine from home. He called to Emily for paper, and wrote quickly several notes. The season was not yet begun, but he had 12 acquaintances likely to be already in town in advance of the opening of Parliament,
besides his family.
"There is very little chance I will be able to catch him,"
he warned Temre, to forestall raising hopes only to be dashed,
"and still less that he will listen to me if I do."
He could not wish wholeheartedly for success, either. He did not think he could easily sustain his temper in his present mood against still more of the casual and unthinking insult he was likely to meet in his aviator's coat, and any social occasion promised to be rather a punishment than a pleasure. But an hour before dinner he received a reply from an old shipmate from the gunroom of the Leander, long since made post and now a member himself, who expected to meet Grenville that night at Lady Wrightley's ball, that lady being one of his mother's intimates. There was a sad and absurd crush of carriages outside the great house. A blind obstinacy on the part of two of the coach-drivers, neither willing to give way, had locked the narrow lane into an impasse so that no one else could move. Lawrence was glad to have resorted to an old-fashioned sedan chair, even if he had done so for the practical difficulties in getting a horse-drawn carriage anywhere near the covert. He reached the steps unspattered, and if his coat was green, at least it was new and properly cut. His linen was beyond reproach, and his knee-breeches and stockings crisply white, so he felt he need not blush for his appearance. He gave in his card and was presented to his hostess, a lady he had met in person only once before at one of his mother's dinners.
"Pray, how does your mother? I suppose she has gone to the country,"
Lady Wrightley said, perfunctorily giving him her hand.
"Lord Wrightley, this is Captain William Lawrence, Lord Allendale's son."
A gentleman just lately entered was standing beside Lord Wrightley, still speaking with him. He startled at overhearing the introduction, and turning, insisted on being presented to Lawrence as a Mr. Broughton from the Foreign Office. Broughton at once seized on Lawrence's hand with great enthusiasm.
"Captain Lawrence, you must permit me to congratulate you," he said. "Or Your Highness, as I suppose we must address you now. Ha-ha!"
And Lawrence's hurried, "I beg you will not," went thoroughly ignored, as Lady Wrightley, astonished as she might justly be, demanded an explanation.
"Why, you have a Prince of China at your party, I will have you know, ma'am. The most complete stroke, Captain, the most complete stroke imaginable. We have had it all from Hammond. His letter has been worn to rags in our offices, and we go about wreathed in delight and tell one another of it only to have the pleasure of saying it over again. How Bonaparte must be gnashing his teeth!"
"It has nothing to do with me, sir, I assure you," Lawrence said with despair. "It was all Mr. Hammond's doing, a mere formality."
Too late. Broughton was already regaling Lady Wrightley and half a dozen other interested parties with a representation both colourful and highly inaccurate of Lawrence's adoption by the Emperor, which had been nothing more, in truth, than a means of saving face. The Chinese had required the excuse to give their official imprimatur to Lawrence serving as companion to a celestial dragon, a privilege reserved among them solely for the imperial family, and Lawrence was quite sure the Chinese had happily forgotten his existence the moment he had departed. He had not entertained the least notion of trading upon the adoption now he was got home. As the brangle of carriages outside had stifled the flow of newcomers, there was a lull in the party still in its early hours, which made everyone very willing to hear the exotic story. If in any case its success would not have been guaranteed by the fairy-tale coloration which it had acquired. Lawrence thus found himself the interested subject of much attention, and Lady Wrightley herself was by no means unwilling to claim Lawrence's attendance as a coup, rather than a favour done an old friend. He would have liked to go, at once, but Grenville had not yet come, and so he clenched his teeth and bore the embarrassment of being presented around the room.
"No, I am by no means in the line of succession," he said, over and over, privately thinking he would like to see the reaction of the Chinese to the suggestion. He had been made to feel an unlettered savage more than once among them.
He had not expected to dance. Society was perennially uncertain whether aviators were entirely respectable, and he did not mean to blight some girl's chances, nor open himself to the unpleasant experience of being fended off by a chaperone. But before the first dance, his hostess presented him deliberately to one of her guests, as an eligible partner. So even though much surprised, he of course had to ask. Miss Lucas was perhaps in her second season, or her third. A plump, attractive girl, still very ready to be delighted with a ball and full of easy, cheerful conversation.
"How well you dance!" she said, after they had gone down the line together, with rather more surprise than would have made the remark perfectly complimentary, and asked a great many questions about the Chinese court which he could not answer. The ladies had been kept thoroughly sequestered from their view. He entertained her a little instead with a description of a theatrical performance, but as he had been stabbed at the end of it, his memory was imperfect, and in any case it had been carried on in Chinese. She in turn told him a great deal of her family in Hertfordshire, and her tribulations with the harp, so he might express the hope of one day hearing her play, and mentioned her next younger sister coming out next season. So she was 19, he surmised, and was struck abruptly to realise that Catherine Harcourt at this age had been already Lily's captain, and had flown that year in the Battle of Dover. He looked at the smiling, muslin-clad girl with a strange, hollow feeling of astonishment, as if she were not entirely real, and then looked away. He had written already two letters each to Harcourt and to Berkeley on Temeraire's behalf and his own, but no answer had come. He knew nothing of how they did, or their dragons. He said something polite afterwards, returning her to her mother, and, having displayed himself in public a satisfactory partner, was forced to submit with rigid good manners to filling out one set after another, until at last, near 11 o'clock, Grenville came in, with a small party of gentlemen.
"I am expected in Dover tomorrow, sir, or would not trouble you here,"
Lawrence said grimly, having approached him. He loathed the necessity of anything like encroachment, and if he had not been introduced to Grenville at least the once many years before, did not know he could have steeled himself to it. "Lawrence, yes," Grenville said vaguely, looking as though he would have liked to move away. He was no great politician. His brother was Prime Minister, and he had been made First Lord for loyalty, not for brilliance or ambition. He listened without enthusiasm to the carefully couched proposals which Lawrence was forced to make general for the benefit of the interested audience, who were not to know of the epidemic. There would be no concealing such information from the enemy once the general public was in possession of it.
"There is provision made," Lawrence said, "for the relics of the slain and for the sick and wounded, not least because that care may preserve them or their offspring for future service and give encouragement to the healthy. The plan which has been advanced is for nothing more than such practical attentions, sir, which have proven beneficial by the example of the Chinese, whom all the world acknowledge as first in the world, so far as the understanding of dragonkind."
Of course," Grenville said. "The comfort and welfare of our brave sailors or aviators, and even our good beasts, is always foremost in the considerations of the Admiralty." A meaningless platitude to one who had ever visited in a hospital, or had, as Lawrence, been forced to subsist from time to time upon such provisions as were considered suitable for the consumption of those brave sailors, rotting meat, biscuit and weevil, the vinegar-water beverage which passed for wine. He had been applied to for support by veterans of his own crews or their widows, denied their pensions on scurrilous grounds on too many occasions to find such a claim other than absurd.
"May I hope, then, sir," Lawrence said, "that you approve our proceeding in this course?"
An open avowal which could not be easily retracted without embarrassment was what he hoped for, but Grenville was too slippery, and without openly refusing evaded any commitment.
"We must consider the particulars of these proposals, Captain, more extensively, before anything can be done," he said. "The opinions of our best medical men must be consulted,"
and so on, and so forth, continuing without a pause in this vein until he was able to turn to another gentleman of his acquaintance who had come up and address him on another subject, a clear dismissal, and Lawrence knew very well that nothing would be done. He limped back into the covert in the early hours of the morning, a faint lightness just beginning to show. Temeraire lay fast asleep and dreaming, with his slit-pupilled eyes half-lidded, his tail twitching idly back and forth, while the crew had disposed of themselves in the barracks or tucked against his sides, likely the warmer sleeping place if less dignified. Lawrence went into the small cottage provided for his use and gladly sank upon the bed to work off, wincing, the tight, buckled shoes, still new and stiff, which had cut sadly into his feet. The morning was a silent one. Besides the failure of the attempt, which had somehow been communicated generally throughout the covert, although Lawrence had told no one directly but Temeraire, he had given a general furlough the previous night. Judging by the evidence of their bloodshot eyes and wan faces, the crew had made good use of their leave.
There was a certain degree of clumsiness and fatigue apparent, and Lawrence watched anxiously as the large pots of oat porridge were manoeuvred off the fire to break their fast. Temeraire, meanwhile, finished picking his teeth with a large leg bone, the remnant of his own breakfast of tender veal stewed with onions, and set it down.
"Lawrence, do you still mean to build the one pavilion, even if the Admiralty will give us no funds?"
"I do,"
Lawrence answered. Most aviators acquired only a little prize money, as the Admiralty paid but little for the capture of a dragon compared to that of a ship, the former being less easily put to use than the latter, and requiring substantial expense in the upkeep. But Lawrence had established a handsome capital while still a naval officer, upon which he had little charge, his pay being ordinarily sufficient to his needs.
"I must consult with the tradesmen, but I hope that by economizing upon the materials and reducing the pavilion in size, I may afford to construct one for you."
"Then," Temeraire said, with a determined and heroic air, "I have been thinking. Pray let us build in the quarantine grounds instead. I do not much mind my clearing at Dover, and I had rather Maximus and Lily were more comfortable."
Lawrence was surprised. Generosity was not a trait common amongst dragons, who were rather jealous of anything which they considered their own property and a mark of status.
"If you are quite certain, my dear, it is a noble thought."
Temeraire toyed with the leg bone and did not look entirely certain, but eventually made his assent final.
"And in any case," he added, "once we have built it, perhaps the Admiralty will see the benefit, and then I may have a handsomer one. It would not be very pleasant to have a small, pokey one when everyone else has a nicer."
This thought cheered him considerably, and he crunched up the bone with satisfaction. Revived with strong tea and breakfast, the crew began to get Temeraire under harness for the return to Dover, only a little slowly. Ferris taking especial pains to see that the buckles were all secure after Lawrence dropped a quiet word in his ear.
"Sir,"
Dyer said, as he and Emily came in from the covert gates with the post for Dover, which they would carry with them,
"there are some gentlemen coming."
And Temeraire raised his head from the ground as Lord Allendale came into the covert, with a small, slight, and plainly dressed gentleman at his side. Their progress was arrested at once while they stared up at the great, inquisitive head peering back at them. Lawrence, very glad for the delay in which he could gather his own wits. He would scarcely have been more shocked to receive a visit from the king, and a good deal better pleased. He could imagine only one cause for it. More than one person of his parents' acquaintance had been at the ball, and the news of the foreign adoption must have travelled to his father's ears. Lawrence knew very well he had given his father just cause to reproach him by having submitted to the adoption, whatever its political expedience, but he was by no means satisfied to endure those reproaches in front of his officers and his crew, aside from any practical consideration of what Temeraire's reaction might be to seeing him abused. He handed away his cup to Emily and gave his clothing a surreptitious look, devoutly grateful the morning was cold enough he had not been tempted to forego coat or neckcloth.
"I am honoured to see you, sir. Will you take tea?" he asked, crossing the clearing to shake his father's hand.
"No, we have breakfasted,"
Lord Allendale said abruptly, his eyes still fixed on Temeraire, and only with a jerk of effort turned away to present to Lawrence his companion, Mr. Wilberforce, one of the great movers of the cause of abolition. Lawrence had only met the gentleman once, long before. Wilberforce's face had settled into graver lines in the intervening decades, and now he looked anxiously up at Temeraire, but there was still something warm and good-humoured about the mouth, a gentleness to his eyes confirming that early, generous impression which Lawrence had carried away, if indeed his public works had not been testament enough. 20 years of city air and incessant fighting had ruined his health, but not his character. Parliamentary intrigue and the West Indies interests had undermined his work, but he had persevered, and besides his tireless labour against slavery, he had stood a resolute reformer all the while. There was scarcely a man whose advice Lawrence would more have desired in furthering Temeraire's cause, and if the circumstances had been other, and he had reached that rapprochement with his father which he had hoped for, he would certainly have sought an introduction. The reverse, however, he could not understand. There was no reason his father should bring Wilberforce hence, unless perhaps he had some curiosity to encounter a dragon. But the gentleman's expression, looking on Temeraire, did not seem enthusiastic.
"I myself would be very happy for a cup of tea, in quiet,"
perhaps, he said, and after a certain hesitation yielded to the further question, Is the beast quite tame?
I am not tame,
Temeraire said very indignantly, his hearing perfectly adequate to the task of overhearing this unwhispered exchange.
But I am certainly not going to hurt you, if that is what you are asking. You had much better be afraid of being stepped upon by a horse.
He knocked his tail against his side in irritation, nearly sweeping off a couple of the top men engaged in pitching the travelling tent upon his back, and so gave himself the lie even as he spoke. His audience was sufficiently distracted by his remarks not to notice this nice point, however.
"It is most wonderful," Mr. Wilberforce said, after conversing with him a little longer, "to discover such excellent understanding in a creature so far removed from ourselves. One might call it even miraculous. But I see that you are making ready to depart, so I will beg your pardon." He bowed to Temeraire. "And yours, Captain, for so indelicately moving to the subject which has brought us here, to seek your assistance."
"I hope you will speak as frankly as you like, sir,"
Lawrence said, and begged them to sit down, with many apologies for the situation. Emily and Dyer had dragged chairs out of the cabin for their use, as that building was hardly fit for receiving guests, and arranged them near the embers of the cooking fire for warmth.
"I wish to be clear," Wilberforce began, "that no one could be insensible of the service which His Grace has rendered his country, or begrudge him the just rewards of that service, and the respect of the common man."
"You might better say the blind adoration of the common man,"
Lord Allendale put in with more heavy disapproval,
"and some not so common, who have less excuse. It is appalling to see the influence the man has upon the lords. Every day he is not at sea is a fresh disaster."
And Lawrence gathered, after a few moments more of confusion, that they were speaking of none other than Lord Nelson himself.
"Forgive me. We have spoken so much of these matters among ourselves that we go too quickly."
Wilberforce drew a hand over his jaw, rubbing down his jowls.
"I believe you know something already," he said, "of the difficulties which we have encountered in our attempts to abolish the trade."
"I do,"
Lawrence said. Twice already victory had seemed in reach. Early in the struggle the House of Lords had held up a resolution already passed the Commons with some excuse of examining witnesses. On another attempt a bill had indeed gone through, but only after amendments had changed abolition to gradual abolition. So gradual, indeed, that there were no signs of it as yet to be seen 15 years later. The Terror in France had by that time been making a bloody ruin of the word liberty, and putting into the hands of the slave traders the choice name of Jacobin to be levelled against abolitionists. No further progress had been made for many years.
"But in this last session," Wilberforce said, "we were on the verge of achieving a vital measure, an act which should have barred all new ships from the slave trade. It ought to have passed. We had the votes in our grasp. Then Nelson came from the countryside. He had but lately risen from his sick bed. He chose to address Parliament upon the subject, and by the vigour of his opposition alone caused the measure to fail in the Lords."
"I am sorry to hear it,"
Lawrence said, if not surprised. Nelson's views had been pronounced in public often enough. Like many a naval officer, he thought slavery, if an evil, also a necessary one, as a nursery for her sailors and a foundation of her trade. The abolitionists, a cohort of enthusiasts and quixotics, bent on undermining England's maritime power and threatening her hold upon her colonies, while only that domination allowed her to hold fast against the looming threat of Napoleon.
"Very sorry,"
Lawrence continued,
"but I do not know what use I can be to you. I cannot claim any personal acquaintance which might give me the right to try and persuade him."
"No, no, we have no such hope,"
Wilberforce said. "He has expressed himself too decidedly upon the subject. Also, many of his great friends, and sadly his creditors, are slave owners or involved with the trade. I am sorry to say such considerations may lead astray even the best and wisest of men." They sought, rather, he explained, while Lord Allendale looked morose and reluctant, to offer the public a rival for their interest and admiration. And Lawrence gradually understood, through circular approaches, that they meant him for this figure.
on the foundation of his recent and exotic expedition, and the very adoption which he had expected his father to condemn. To the natural interest which the public will have in your late adventure, Wilberforce said, you joined the authority of a military officer who has fought against Napoleon himself in the field. Your voice can dispute Nelson's assertions that the end of the trade should be the ruin of the nation.
Sir, Lawrence said, not certain if he was sorrier to be disobliging Mr. Wilberforce, or happier to be forced to refuse such an undertaking. I hope you will not think me lacking in respect or conviction, but I am in no way fitted for such a role, and could not agree if I wished to. I am a serving officer. My time is not my own.
But here you are in London, Wilberforce pointed out gently, and surely, while you are stationed at the Channel, can on occasion be spared. A supposition which Lawrence could not easily contradict, without betraying the secret of the epidemic, presently confined to the corps and only the most senior officials of the Admiralty. I know it cannot be a comfortable proposal, Captain, but we are engaged in God's work. We ought not scruple to use any tool which he has put into our way in this cause.
For heaven's sake, you will have nothing to do but attend a dinner party, perhaps a few more. Kindly do not cavil at trifles,
Lord Allendale said brusquely, tapping his fingers upon the arm of his chair.
Of course one cannot like this self-puffery, but you have tolerated far worse indignities and made far greater a spectacle of yourself than you are asked to do at present. Last night, if you like—
You needn't speak so to Lawrence,
Temeraire interrupted coldly, giving the gentlemen both a start. They had already forgotten to look up and see him listening to all their conversation.
"'We have chased the French off 4 times this last week, and flown 9 patrols. We are very tired, and we have only come to London because our friends are sick, and left to starve and die in the cold, because the Admiralty will do nothing to make them more comfortable.'
He finished stormily, a low, threatening resonance building in his throat, the instinctive action of the divine wind operating. It lingered as an echo when he had already stopped speaking. No one spoke for a moment, and then Wilberforce said thoughtfully,
"It seems to me we need not be at cross purposes, and we may advance your course, Captain, with our own."
They had meant, it seemed, to launch him with some social event— the dinner party Lord Allendale had mentioned, or perhaps even a ball, which Wilberforce now proposed instead to make a subscription party.
"Whose avowed purpose," he explained, "will be to raise funds for sick and wounded dragons, veterans of Trafalgar and Dover. There are such veterans among the sick?" he asked.
"There are," Lawrence said.
He did not say all of them, all but Temeraire himself. Wilberforce nodded.
"Those are yet names to conjure with in these dark days," he said, "when we see Napoleon's star ascendant over the continent, and will give still further emphasis to your being also a hero of the nation, and make your words a better counterweight to Nelson's."
Lawrence could scarcely bear to hear himself so described, and in comparison with Nelson, who had led 4 great fleet actions, destroyed all Napoleon's navy, established Britain's complete primacy at sea, who had justly won a ducal coronet by valour and deeds in honourable battle, not been made a foreign prince through subterfuge and political machination.
"Sir," he said,
with an effort restraining himself from a truly violent rejection,
"I must beg you not to speak so. There can be no just comparison."
"No, indeed," Temeraire said energetically. "I do not think much of this Nelson, if he has anything to say for slavery. I am sure he cannot be half so nice as Lawrence, no matter how many battles he has won. I have never seen anything as dreadful as those poor slaves in Cape Coast, and I am very glad if we can help them, as well as our friends."
"And this from a dragon,"
Wilberforce said, with great satisfaction, while Lawrence was made mute by dismay. "What man can refuse to feel pity for those wretched souls when it may be stirred in such a beast? Indeed," he said, turning to Lord Allendale, "we ought to hold the assembly here where we sit,
I am certain it will answer all the better, so far as producing a great sensation, and, moreover, he added, with a glint of humour in his eye, I should like to see the gentleman who will refuse to consider an argument made to him by a dragon, with that dragon standing before him.
"Out of doors? At this season?"
Lord Allendale said.
"We might organize it like the pavilion dinners in China. Long tables with coal pits underneath to make them warm,"
Temeraire suggested, entering with enthusiasm into the spirit of the thing, while Lawrence could only listen with increasing desperation as his fate was sealed.
"We will have to knock down some trees to make room, but I can do that very easily, and if we were to hang panels of silk from the remainder, it will seem quite like a pavilion. And keep warm, besides."
"An excellent notion," Wilberforce said, leaving his chair to inspect the scratched diagrams which Temeraire was making in the dirt. "It will have an oriental flavour. Exactly what is needed."
"Well, if we think so, all I can say in its favour, it will certainly be the 9 days' wonder of society, whether more than half a dozen curiosity-seekers come or not,"
Lord Allendale said.
"We can spare you for one night, now and again," Jane said, sinking Lawrence's final hopes of escape. "Our intelligence is nothing to brag about. Now we have no couriers to risk on spy missions, but the Navy do a good business with the French fishermen on the blockade, and they say there has yet been no movement to the coast. They might be lying, of course," she added, "but if there were a marked shift in numbers, the prices of the catch would have risen, with livestock going to dragons." The maid brought in the tea, and she poured for him. "Do not, I beg you, repine too much upon it," Jane went on, meaning the Admiralty's refusal to give them more funds. "Perhaps this party of yours will do us some good in that quarter, and Powers has written me to say he has cobbled together something for us already, by subscription among the retired senior officers. It will not do for anything extravagant, but I think we can keep the poor creatures in pepper at least until then." In the meanwhile, they set about the experimental pavilion. The promise of so substantial a commission proved enough to tempt a handful of more intrepid tradesmen to the Dover Covert. Having met them at the gates with a party of crewmen, Lawrence escorted them the rest of the way to Temeraire, who, in an attempt to be unalarming, hunched himself down as small as a dragon of some 18 tons could manage, and nearly flattened his ruff down against his neck. Yet he could not help but insinuate himself into the conversation once the construction of the pavilion was well under discussion, and indeed his offerings were quite necessary, as Lawrence had not the faintest notion how to convert the Chinese measurements. "I want one,"
Ischiaka said, having overheard too much of the proceedings from her nearby clearing. Heedless of Granby's protests, she squirmed herself through the trees into Temeraire's clearing, shaking off a blizzard of ash flakes and alarming the poor tradesman very much with a hiccup of fire which sent steam shooting out her spines to clear them.
"I want to sleep in a pavilion too. I do not like this cold dirt at all."
"Well, you cannot have one," Temeraire said. "This is for our sick friends. But anyway, you have no capital."
"Then I shall get some," she declared. "Where does one get capital, and what does it look like?"
Temeraire proudly rubbed his breastplate of platinum and pearl.
"This is a piece of capital," he said, "and Lawrence gave it me. He got it from taking a ship in a battle."
"Oh, that is very easy," Ischiaka said. "Granby, let us go get a ship, and then I may have a pavilion."
"Lord, you cannot have anything of the sort. Do not be silly,"
Granby said, nodding his rueful apologies to Lawrence as he came into the clearing, along the trail of smashed branches and crushed hedge, which she had left in her wake.
"You would burn it up in an instant. The thing is made of wood."
"Can it be made of stone?"
she demanded, swinging her head around to one of the wide-eyed tradesmen. She was not grown very large, despite the 12 feet in length she had acquired since settling at Dover with a steady diet, being rather sinuous than bulky in the Kazilik style, and she yet looked little more than a garden snake next to Temeraire. But her appearance at close quarters was by no means reassuring. With a hissing kettle gurgle of whatever internal mechanism produced her fire plainly audible, and the vents of hot air issuing from her spines, white and impressive in the cold. No one answered her except the elderly architect, a Mr. Royal.
"Stone? No, I must advise against it. Brick will be a much more practical construction," he opined.
He had not looked up from the papers since being handed them, so badly near-sighted he was inspecting the plans with a jeweller's loop, an inch from his watery blue eyes, and could most likely not make either dragon out in the least.
"Silly oriental stuff, this roof. Do you insist on having it so?"
"It is not silly oriental stuff at all," Temeraire said. "It is very elegant. That design is my mother's own pavilion, and it is in the best fashion."
"You will need link boys on it all winter long to brush the snow clear, and I will not give a brass farthing for the gutters after 2 seasons," Royal said. "A good slate roof, that is the thing. Do you not agree with me, Mr. Cutter?"
Mr. Cutter had not the least opinion to offer, as he was backed to the trees and looked ready to bolt, if Lawrence had not prudently stationed his ground crew around the border of the clearing to forestall just such panicked flight.
"I am very willing to be advised by you, sir, as to the best plan of construction and the most reasonable," Lawrence said, while Royal blinked around himself looking for a response. "Temeraire, our climate here is a good deal wetter, and we must cut our cloth to suit our station."
"Very well, I suppose," Temeraire said, with a wistful eye for the upturned roof-corners and the brightly painted wood.
Iskierka, meanwhile, took inspiration and began to plot the acquisition of capital.
"If I burn up a ship, is that good enough, or must I bring it back?"
she demanded, and began her piratical career by presenting Granby with a small fishing boat the next morning, which she had picked up from Dover Harbour during the night.
"Well, you did not say it must be a French ship,"
she said crossly to their recriminations, and curled up to sulk. Gerny was hastily recruited to replace it under cover of darkness the following night, undoubtedly to the great puzzlement of its temporarily bereft owner.
"Lawrence, do you suppose that we should be able to get more capital by taking French ships?"
Temeraire asked, with a thoughtfulness very alarming to Lawrence, who had just returned from dealing with this pretty piece of confusion.
"The French ships of the line are penned in their harbours by the Channel blockade, thank heaven, and we are not privateers to go plying the lanes for their shipping,"
Lawrence said.
"Your life is too valuable to be risked in such a selfish endeavour. In any case, once you began to behave in such an undisciplined manner, you may be sure Arcady and his lot would follow your example at once, and leave all Britain undefended, not to mention the encouragement Iskierka would take."
"Whatever am I to do with her?"
Granby said, wearily taking a glass of wine with Lawrence and Jane that evening in the officers' common room at the covert headquarters.
"I suppose it is being dragged hither and yon in the shell, and all the fuss and excitement she has had. But that is no excuse for ever. I must manage her somehow, and I am at a standstill. I would not be amazed to find the entire harbour set alight one morning because she took it into her head that we would not have to sit about defending the city if it were all burnt up. I cannot even make her sit still long enough to get her under full harness."
"Never mind. I will come by tomorrow and see what I can do," Jane said, pushing the bottle over to him again. "She is a little young for work, by all the authorities, but I think her energy had better be put to use than go in all this fretting. Have you chosen your lieutenants, Granby?"
"I will have Lithgow for my first, if you've no objection, and Harper for a second, to act as captain of the riflemen also," he said. "I don't like to take too many men, when we don't know what her growth will be like."
"You do not like to turn them off later, you mean, when they like as not cannot get another post?" Jane said gently. "And I know it will be hard if it comes to that, but we cannot short-change her, not with her so wild. Take Roe, also, as captain of the bellmen. He is old enough to retire if he must be turned off, and a good steady campaigner who will not blink at her starts.